I am a lifelong UU. When I grew up, my mom was joyfully joining the Universalist Unitarian. Thank you. A church of Riverside, California. And I was a little girl, and my mom would drag me to the local coffee shop, and the women's group would gather and do dream work. So my life, my early childhood was spent at the feet of women doing dream work. Drinking coffee at 8 p.m. How they did it, I don't know. Good dreams, I imagine. So I want to tell you a dream story. I want to cast a dream for you. And I want to invite you to play with it the way those women who I used to hear above my head would play with it, which is to say that every character, every entity in the dream is part of you. So let these characters, they'll be familiar and unfamiliar. Let these characters be your dream images, and maybe each of them will speak to something that matters to you right now. So once upon a time, there was a garden named Eden. And inside this garden lived a woman named Eve, and she loved that garden. She knew its pathways, its waterways, the best stones for building altars. She knew the water and the way the lavender and lemon balm smelled, crushed between fingertips. And one of her best friends was Snake. She and Snake would spend hours together. Snake knew how to see something from a different perspective. They would spend hours talking, Snake wrapped up beside her, warm in Eden's sunshine and good with questions. The kind of wisdom that comes when you live your life with your belly to the ground. Now, Snake knew something was funky up in here. This garden was a walled space, the kind of wall, perhaps a boundary, but now a border. And Snake could feel it. And Eve would notice the glimmer at the top of the wall. Was that barbed wire? Broken glass? And one day, as they moved along the perimeter of the tall walls, they inquired with the angels at the security guest checkpoint. What is beyond? May we see? May we know? Oh, said the guardian angel, never you mind that. You have everything you need right here. Everything is perfect. God has created a perfect place. God has given you all that you need. What is beyond the gate does not concern you. So go back. Enjoy what God made for you. Now, God, by some definitions, is a steward. By others, a landlord, and yet further still, a warden. And perhaps all three are true at once. But now Eve and Snake are very curious. There is something undeniable within them that resists their infantilization. They wonder what they can do. Who should we ask for help? Who is the wisest of the garden, they wonder, both realizing the answer at the same time, the trees, of course. They move along the pathway, the stream, the lavender, the lemon balm, the rock altar, and they find their comrade, Adam, along the way, and they ask him to join in. Now, Adam has a slightly different relationship to God and feels a little more uncertain. Still, he sees something true in his friend's movement, the glimmer in their eyes, the testimony in their voices, and there is trust. So Adam, not fully understanding nor fully comfortable, goes with them. The tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil were magnificent elder trees. They are the only ones in the garden with the deepest knotted roots, and in their branches are those holes from birds nesting and gathering, and God doted on these trees, tending them meticulously over time as the branches had begun to fall. Eve and Adam would see God scaffolding them back up, disappearing any evidence of their aging. These were the tree of life, not the tree of death. After all, she must look presentable. So the group approached the two trees. Which one should they choose? Let us eat from the knowledge of good and evil. And Adam looks uncomfortable. Are you sure we should do this? No, Eve replies. But are you sure we shouldn't? No, Adam responds. May it be so, says the snake. And just as snake offers the blessing, the trees lean in. They stretch their scaffolding like grandparents at a rite of passage, knowing that communal struggle is necessary. And they bite. But leaning and leaning over, having been begged to be eaten, the trees begin to collapse. The crackling and the crumbling of the branches send a shock through the garden, root systems talking to root systems of liberation. And as more and more trees that were scaffolded get tumbled over, the trio makes their way to the security gate. Having been rocked open by the quaking trees, the gate is now relieved to be wide. And the three of them make a run for it, leaving bits of fruit along the way. A crumbling trail of possibility for all who dare might follow. Now the sound of the breaking and the popping alerts God, who had been wondering about their day, propping up the trees of the garden. And needless to say, when God fully realizes what has happened, God is quick to anger. Have you, empathy for God, ever tried so hard to protect something by requiring that it do what you asked of it? And then how do you feel when inevitably it does not? So God, running, panting, fumbling, spitting, hissing, crying, God follows the trail of fruit, stopping at the edge of the gate with the angels, seeing the three figures disappearing on the horizon. Screw them! God cries, I will curse them. They shall be wounded, displaced, exiled, all genders, all abilities, all beings, all lovers, all ages, unworthy. They are ungrateful. Don't they know it was perfect? They shall be separate and alone, and they will hear these words, they will read these words, and they will spend their lives believing it. God throws themselves on the ground, watching the shadows on the horizon. But God's face finally is in the dirt. Anger turns to grief. What should I do? God pleads with themselves. So God is finally there like snake. Belly to the ground, heart, ear to the ground, and the ground answers back. You know what to do. And from the ground, God sees one tiny piece of fruit. And with childlike precision and trembling hands, God reaches for it. We pause our dream here. This moment matters. It can be easy for us to see ourselves as only the Adams and Eves and snakes of the world. How often we introduce ourselves, even in a faith community like this, with the story of our exile, our spiritual exile, the places we left behind to come here, the story of my innocence from those terrible people, my righteousness, the story of how someone else or something else was wrong or bad, and I had to leave to seek something better. And that is an important strategy, at some capacity our ability to exit. That has absolutely served us. It has absolutely helped survive. I am a divorced woman. I love a good exit. But it also is a strategy and other hands and other ways of beings that has fueled some of the greatest harms. Exile and exit stage left substantiates settler colonialism because I can leave my place and take yours. It allows mass incarceration because I can send you away. It fills our veins with microplastics and toxins and our neighborhoods and waterways with poisons because I can use something, and then when I don't want it anymore, I can just make it disappear to me. It allows me to self-righteously give you this sermon by typing it on a computer, fueled and mined by some other person's child's hands. It will fuel the tank that flies Elon Musk anywhere the hell else he wants to go. And if exit stage left is the strategy we spend the most time cultivating, it risks becoming our only skill. And we can satisfy ourselves or drive ourselves endlessly with the conclusion that there is a different place or a different person or a different religion or a different political party or maybe a solution or a new technology or maybe a better government that will make us newly innocent again. Newly beginning, newly progressing. We can either make the current one, like the old one we really liked, just rebuild the garden as it was, the way God liked it, or we can go somewhere else and we can start anew. So it really matters what our people do here. And when I first wrote this story, I was in my early 20s. I was displaced from that lifelong beneath the legs of the dream work women, Unitarian Universalism, and I was utterly disenchanted with the garden. I grew up as a teenager surrounded by UU community. I talked about becoming a minister early on, but by young adulthood, I had a developmentally appropriate disenchantment. Yes, developmentally supported, but also structurally substantiated, right? Like a story with an inevitable ending, UUism was a garden of a childhood that did not feel relevant in the world of my millennial young adulthood. So my young adult narrator was delightfully self-righteous. She was very content with a jailbreak and a regretful God. And in the young adult version of the story, God takes that bite of fruit, picks their butt up, dusts their naked self off, and follows those shadows into the world to rebuild the new good thing, following it exactly the way Eve tells him to. Why? Because God needed a change of perspective, some humility, and some goddamn self-responsibility. And surely, Eve and Snake would always make something better than that. It was my young adult response to the conundrum of God in Eden. What do you do when your parents' thing doesn't work out? That's fine. Leave it. Build something better. But now, here, past the tipping point precipice of a broken world with nowhere else to go, I am not satisfied. I feel a little bit like Eve and Adam and Snake, and we only just made it out of one of those fancy escape rooms in San Francisco. And we are standing in the lobby somewhere taking a selfie with free bumper stickers that say, "We escaped," before we get back into our cars and feel the existential dread of all that we cannot escape in this world. All the creation that got created by destroying it, and all the money we just paid to the San Francisco escape room that will pad the retirement of a tech bro. So there's nowhere else to go. I want to know, what are we going to do with Eden? There's nowhere else to go. What are we going to do with Eden? And I think about this in the context of UU institutions, and as a conflict consultant, I mostly meet organizations when they feel the most vulnerable, the most uncertain. And I know that our UU organizations need reimagining. They can't go back to the garden they were, nor are they certain of which way to go. But I also know this in our other public institutions. The ones we see crumbling with heartbreak are public education, our health care, environmental protections, legal protections, all while global capital makes a break for it, charging ahead without care. Now, my husband and I are the children of public educators. We put our child into kindergarten at Oakland Unified School District this year, a school district that operates at a $4 million deficit per a month. Per month. So I am grieving. I keep my child in public school because I believe in integration. And I believe that our values call us to nurture and sustain the common good. But I'm not going to fool myself or others with the belief that there is a version of our public education system that is ever fully satisfied, ever deeply satisfied, the sacred longing we have for every child. I know that. My mom, the devoted dream work public educator, also retired knowing that. So we live in gardens built and planted and imagined by other people at other times, based on what they thought would nourish and sustain and meet life as they knew it then, in the face of what they knew then, by the people who were in power then. And they were born of power structures and beliefs we know do not serve the fullness of interdependence. And the only hope that I feel is that even in these crumbling gardens of domination, there are always a couple of trees. And trees know better. Trees know shit must change. There's a decolonial educator. Her name is Vanessa de Mercado Oliveira, and she has an educational community of indigenous educators and artists called the Gesturing Towards Decolonial Futures Collective. And they ask us not to prop up the old, because we cannot, nor we should not, save it. But nor can we imagine some kind of free, open space where we just create something new as if we won't be shaped by the thing we just came from. They say our task is metabolism. The metabolic practice is the capacity to simultaneously assist something in its dying, that is, hospicing, and to assist something in its birthing, that is, midwifing, simultaneously. All while you resist your urge to suffocate the future with your projections of what you think it should be, born of the grief of your past experience. Essentially, it's composting. Now, in this decolonial collective's work, Vanessa invites us to look at the ivory tower of the university, to apply the metaphor to just one of our beloved crumbling institutions. Now, our traditional notion of the ivory tower is one detached from reality, where the best and brightest describe and prescribe what is and what should be. But that model, much like our public education system, is also rooted in the power systems of our forebears. They include the colonial, racist, patriarchal legacies that are misaligned with the challenges we face today. So she says, a more appropriate metaphor than the ivory tower is the Leaning Tower of Pisa. In which it is precariously tilting amidst a swamp of unprecedented challenges. Now, the challenges of that tower are familiar to us. They are the challenges of financial uncertainty, affordability, the complexities of our diversity and our decolonization, our intergenerational dissonance, our ecological destabilization, our ambivalence about existential questions of emergent technologies, our mental health, our polarization, and our lack of capacity to coordinate across difference. All of these makes the swamp of the unprecedented challenges all of our institutions are facing. So frankly, it's like the curse of God's separateness made real. But most of our institutions face some version of this. These are the symbols of a crumbling modernity. This is what modernity looks like when it's crumbling. So Vanessa suggests that the question is not if these institutional towers will fall, it's a question of how. So a hard fall, she suggests, by some kind of rigid adherence to what was. I want it to be what it was. Or some forced reckoning by someone coming in and smashing it down. Read the current administration. All of those methods, rigid holding or utter smashing, would shatter what remains, leaving little chance for regeneration. But if the fall is softened by our willingness to adapt and collaborate, compost our obsolete ideas, and to be guided by a willingness to meet new practices, then maybe there's a potential to transform it into something new. In the soft fall, this tree becomes a nurse log, settling into the earth, connecting to the ground of reality, embraced by moss and mycelium. This crumbling institution becomes fertile ground for redistributing resources, nurturing creativity, fostering regeneration. Here, the fall is not an ending. It's a beginning that invites us to stop clinging and choose nurturing. What if? I wonder what would happen if our religious institutions taught us how to be with nurse logs. This might feel easy to some and hard to others, but like Adam, maybe we don't have to understand everything or feel certain, but we might just know how to say yes. And the spiritual capacity here is willingness without control, a yes without guaranteeing the outcome. The spiritual practice is humility. So where did we leave off? We left off with God on the ground, with fruit on their tongue. And perhaps from this place on the ground, Eden is not perfect. It's not necessary to refurbish, but it's also not condemnable. It's not worthy of our judgment or our snobbery. It's a place to compost, a log to bring down to the earth. And maybe God takes a bite of the fruit. And maybe God kindly requests those angels to fly and tell Adam and Eve and snake that they are open to doing the repair work necessary whenever they are ready for it. And maybe God dusts themselves off and God leaves the gates open and God lets the concrete stay crumbled. And maybe God sits with elder trees, with broken branches and heartwood and crumbling leaves, and maybe God learns something. To let something die, to let something be out of their control, to be with what's uncertain and messy, and God lets trees teach them, and God lets something be born that wasn't theirs and was beyond their imagining and isn't what they would have chosen or wanted or ordered, but God and garden metabolize themselves. And maybe God releases themselves of their own curse of separation. And maybe God moves beyond good and bad. Perhaps God is compost. May it be so.